answer something like that. The lucha. This is a naive view. You know what is naive? A naive view. The real facts are always otherwise. You cannot stay in this place and be independent peoples. You don't know what is the situation here. You don't speak the language.
He speaks it, said Rollins.
Perez shook his head. No, he said, you don't speak it. Maybe in a year here you might understand, but you don't have no year. You don't have no time. If you don't show faith to me, I cannot help you. Do you understand me? I cannot offer to you my help.
John Grady looked at Rollins. You ready, bud?
Yeah, I'm ready.
They pushed back their chairs and rose.
Perez looked up at them. Sit down, please, he said.
There's nothing to sit about.
He drummed his fingers on the table. You are very foolish, he said. Very foolish.
John Grady stood with his hand on the door. He turned and looked at Perez. His face misshapen and his eyes still swollen closed and blue as a plum.
Why don't you tell us what's out there, he said. You talk about showing faith if we don't know. And why don't you tell us?
Perez had not risen from the table. He leaned back and looked at them.
I cannot tell you, he said. That is the truth. I can say certain things about those who come under my protection. But the others...
He made a little gesture of dismissal with the back of his hand.
The others are simply outside. They live in a world of possibility that has no end. Perhaps God can say what is to become of them, but I cannot.
The next morning, crossing the yard, Rollins was set upon by a man with a knife. The man he'd never seen before. And the knife was no homemade truccia, ground out of a trench spoon, but an Italian switchblade with black horn handles and nickel bolsters, and he held it at waist level and passed it 3 times across Rollins' shirt, while Rollins leaped 3 times backward with his shoulders hunched and his arms outflung like a man refereeing his own bloodletting. At the 3rd pass, he turned and ran. He ran with 1 hand across his stomach, and his shirt was wet and sticky. When John Grady got to him, he was sitting with his back to the wall, holding his arms crossed over his stomach and rocking back and forth as if he were cold. John Grady knelt and tried to pull his arms away.
Let me see, damn it. That son of a bitch! That son of a bitch!
Let me see. Rollins leaned back.
Aw, shit,
he said. John Grady lifted the blood-soaked shirt.
It ain't that bad, he said. It ain't that bad.
He cupped his hand and ran it across Rollins' stomach to chase the blood. The lowest cut was the deepest, and it had severed the outer fascia, but it had not gone through into the stomach wall. Rollins looked down at the cuts.
It ain't good, he said. Son of a bitch.
Can you walk?
Yeah, I can walk.
Come on.
Oh, shit, said Rollins. Son of a bitch.
Come on, bud, you can't sit here. He helped Rollins to his feet.
Come on. He said, I got you.
They crossed the quadrangle to the gate shack. The guard looked out through the sally port. He looked at John Grady and he looked at Rollins. Then he opened the gate and John Grady passed Rollins into the hands of his captors. They sat him in a chair and sent for the alcaide. Blood dripped slowly onto the stone floor beneath him. He sat, holding his stomach with both hands. After a while, someone handed him a towel. In the days that followed, John Grady moved about the compound as little as possible. He watched everywhere for the cuchillero who would manifest himself from among the anonymous eyes that watched back. Nothing occurred. He had a few friends among the inmates, an older man from the state of Yucatan who was outside of the factions but was treated with respect, a dark Indian from Sierra Leone, 2 brothers named Bautista who had killed a policeman in Monterey and set fire to the body, and were arrested with the older brother wearing the policeman's shoes. All agreed that Perez was a man whose power could only be guessed at. Some said he was not confined to the prison at all, but went abroad at night, that he kept a wife and family in the town, a mistress. He tried to get some word from the guards concerning Rollins, but they claimed to know nothing. On the morning of the 3rd day after the stabbing, he crossed the yard and tapped at Perez's door. The drone of noise in the yard behind him almost ceased altogether. He could feel the eyes on him, and when Perez's tall chamberlain opened the door, he only glanced at him and then looked beyond and raked the compound with his eyes.
Quisiera hablar con el señor Perez, said John Grady.
Con respecto de qué?
Con respecto de mi cuate.
He shut the door. John Grady waited. After a while, the door opened again.
Pásale,
said the chamberlain. John Grady stepped into the room. Perez's man shut the door and then stood against it. Perez sat at his table.
How is the condition of your friend? He said.
That's what I come to ask you.
Perez smiled. Sit down, please.
Is he alive?
Sit down, I insist.
He stepped to the table and pulled back a chair and sat.
Perhaps you like some coffee?
No, thank you.
Perez leaned back.
Tell me what I can do for you, he said.
You can tell me how my friend is.
But if I answer this question, then you will go away.
What would you want me to stay for?
Perez smiled.
My goodness, he said. To tell me stories of your life of crime, of course.
John Grady studied him.
Like all men of means, said Perez, my only desire is to be entertained.
Me toma el pelo.
Yes. In English you say the leg, I believe.
Yes. You a man of means?
No, it is a joke. I enjoy to practice my English. It passes the time.
Where did you learn Castellano?
At home. In Texas.
Yes.
You learn it from the servants.
We didn't have no servants. We had people worked on the place.
You have been in some prison before?
No.
You are the oveja negra, no? The black sheep?
You don't know nothing about me.
Perhaps not. Tell me, why do you believe that you can be released from your confinement in some abnormal way?
I told you, you're digging a dry hole. You don't know what I believe.
I know the United States. I've been there many times. You are like the Jews. There is always a rich relative. What prison were you in?
You know I ain't been in no prison. Where is Rawlins?
You think I am responsible for the incident to your friend, but that is not the case.
You think I came here to do business. All I want to know is what's happened to him.
Perez nodded thoughtfully.
Even in a place like this, where we are concerned with fundamental things, the mind of the Anglo is closed in this rare way. At one time I thought it was only his life of privilege. But it is not that. It is his mind.
He sat back easily. He tapped his temple.
It is not that he is stupid. It is that his picture of the world is incomplete. In this rare way, he looks only where he wishes to see. You understand me?
I understand you.
Good, said Perez. I can normally tell how intelligent a man is by how stupid he thinks I am.
I don't think you're stupid, I just don't like you.
Ah, said Perez. Very good, very good.
John Grady looked at Perez's man standing against the door. He stood with his eyes caged, looking at nothing.
He doesn't understand what we are saying, said Perez. Feel free to express yourself.
I've done express myself.
Yes. I've got to go.
Do you think you can go if I don't want you to go?
Yes.
Perez smiled.
Are you a cuchillero?
John Grady sat back.
A prison is like a, how do you call it, a salon de belleza.
A beauty parlor.
A beauty parlor. It is a big place for gossip. Everybody knows the story of everybody, because crime is very interesting. Everybody knows that.
We never committed any crimes.
Perhaps not yet.
What does that mean?
Perez shrugged.
They're still looking. Your case is not decided. Did you think your case was decided?
I won't find anything.
My goodness, said Perez. My goodness. You think there are no crimes without owners? It is not a matter of finding. It is only a matter of choosing, like picking the proper suit in a store.
I don't seem to be in any hurry.
or even in Mexico, they cannot keep you indefinitely. That is why you must act. Once you are charged, it will be too late. They will issue what is called the previas. Then there are many difficulties.
He took his cigarettes from his shirt pocket and offered them across the table. John Grady didn't move.
Please, said Perez, it is all right. It is not the same as breaking bread. It places one under no obligation.
He leaned forward and took a cigarette and put it in his mouth. Perez took a lighter from his pocket and snapped it open and lit it and held it across the table.
Where did you learn to fight? He said.
John Grady took a deep pull on the cigarette and leaned back.
What do you want to know? He said. Only what the world wants to know.
What does the world want to know?
The world wants to know if you have cojones, if you are brave.
He lit his own cigarette and laid the lighter on top of the pack of cigarettes on the table and blew a thin stream of smoke.
Then it can decide your price, he said.
Some people don't have a price.
That is true.
What about those people?
Those people die.
I ain't afraid to die.
That is good. It will help you to die.
It will not help you to live. Is Rollins dead?
No, he is not dead.
John Grady pushed back the chair.
Perez smiled easily. You see, he said, you do just as I say.
I don't think so.
You have to make up your mind. You don't have so much time. We never have so much time as we think.
Time's the one thing I've had enough of since I come here.
I hope you will give some thought to your situation. Americans have ideas sometimes that are not so practical. They think that there are good things and bad things. They are very superstitious, you know.
You don't think there's good and bad things?
Things, no. I think it is a superstition. It is the superstition of a godless people.
You think Americans are godless?
Oh, yes, don't you?
No.
I see them attack their own property. I saw a man one time destroy his car with a big martillo. What do you call it?
Hammer.
Because it would not start. Would a Mexican do that?
I don't know.
A Mexican would not do that. The Mexican does not believe that a car can be good or evil. If there is evil in the car, he knows that to destroy the car is to accomplish nothing, because he knows where good and evil have their home. The Anglo thinks in his rare way that the Mexican is superstitious. But who is the one? We know there are qualities to a thing. This car is green, or it has a certain motor inside, but it cannot be tainted, you see. Or a man, even a man, there can be in a man some evil. But we don't think it is his own evil. Where did he get it? How did he come to claim it? No. Evil is a true thing in Mexico. It goes about on its own legs. Maybe someday it will come to visit you. Maybe it already has.
Maybe. Perez smiled.
You are free to go, he said. I can see you don't believe what I tell you. It is the same with money. Americans have this problem always, I believe. They talk about tainted money. But money doesn't have this special quality. And the Mexican would never think to make things special or to put them in a special place where money is no use. Why do this? If money is good, money is good. He doesn't have bad money. He doesn't have this problem, this abnormal thought.
John Grady leaned and stubbed out the cigarette in the tin ashtray on the table. Cigarettes in that world were money themselves, and the one he left broken and smoldering in front of his host had hardly been smoked at all. I'll tell you what, he said. Tell me. I'll see you around. He rose and looked at Perez's man standing against the door. Perez's man looked at Perez.
I thought you wanted to know what would happen out there, said Perez.
John Grady turned.
Would that change it?
He said.
Perez smiled. You do me too much credit. There are 300 men in this institution. No one can know what is possible.
Somebody runs the show.
Perez shrugged. Perhaps, he said. But this type of world, you see, this confinement, it gives a false impression. As if things are in control. If these men could be controlled, they would not be here. You see the problem?
Yes.
You can go. I will be interested myself to see what becomes to you.
He made a small gesture with his hand. His man stepped from before the door and held it open.
Reven, said Perez.
John Grady turned.
Yes,
he said.
Take care with whom you break bread.
All right, I will. Then he turned and walked out into the yard. He still had 45 pesos left from the money Blevins had given him, and he tried to buy a knife with it, but no one would sell him one. He couldn't be sure if there were none for sale or only none for sale to him. He moved across the courtyard at a studied saunter. He found the Bautistas under the shade of the south wall, and he stood until they looked up and gestured to him to come forward. He squatted in front of them.
Quiero comprar una trucha, he said.
They nodded. The one named Faustino spoke.
¿Cuánto dinero tienes?
45 pesos.
They sat for a long time, the dark Indian face ruminating, reflective, as if the complexities of this piece of business dragged after it every sort of consequence. Faustino shaped his mouth to speak.
Bueno, he said. Dámelo.
John Grady looked at them, the lights in their black eyes. If there was guile there, it was of no sort he could reckon with, and he sat in the dirt and pulled off his left boot and reached down into it and took out the small, damp sheaf of bills. They watched him. He pulled the boot back on and sat for a moment with the money palmed between his index and middle finger, and then with a deft card flip shot the folded bills under Faustino's knee. Faustino didn't move.
Bueno, he said. Atendré esta tarde.
He nodded and rose and walked back across the yard. The smell of diesel smoke drifted across the compound, and he could hear the buses in the street outside the gate, and he realized that it was Sunday. He sat alone with his back to the wall. He heard a child crying. He saw the Indian from Sierra Leone coming across the yard, and he spoke to him. The Indian came over.
Siéntate, he said.
The Indian sat. He took from inside his shirt a small paper bag, limp with sweat, and passed it to him. Inside was a handful of punche and a sheaf of cornhusk papers.
Gracias, he said.
He took a paper and folded it and dabbed the rough, stringy tobacco in and rolled it shut and licked it. He handed the tobacco back, and the Indian rolled a cigarette and put the bag back inside his shirt and produced an esclarajo made from a half-inch water pipe coupling, and struck a light and cupped it in his hands and blew up the fire and held it for John Grady and then lit his own cigarette. John Grady thanked him.
¿No tienes visitantes? He said.
The Indian shook his head. He didn't ask John Grady if he had visitors. John Grady thought he might have something to tell him, some news that had moved through the prison but bypassed him in his exile. But the Indian seemed to have no news at all, and they sat, leaning against the wall, smoking until the cigarettes had burned away to nothing, and the Indian let the ashes fall between his feet, and then rose and moved on across the yard. He didn't go to eat at noon. He sat and watched the yard and tried to read the air. He thought men crossing were looking at him. Then he thought they were at pains not to. He said half aloud to himself that all his thinking could get a man killed. Then he said that talking to yourself could also get you killed. A little later he jerked awake and put one hand up. He was horrified to have fallen asleep there. He looked at the width of the shadow of the wall before him. When the yard was half in the shade, it would be 4 o'clock. After a while he got up and walked down to where the Bautistas were sitting. Faustino looked up at him. He gestured for him to come forward. He told him to step slightly to the left. Then he told him he was standing on it. He almost looked down, but he didn't. Faustino nodded.
Siéntate, he said.
He sat.
Hay un cordón.
He looked down. A small piece of string lay under his boot. When he pulled it up under his hand, a knife emerged out of the gravel, and he palmed it and slid it inside the waistband of his trousers. Then he got up and walked away. It was better than what he'd expected. A switchblade with the handles missing, made in Mexico, the brass showing through the plating on the bolsters. He untied the piece of twine from around it and wiped it on his shirt and blew down into the blade channel and tapped it against the heel of his boot and blew again. He pushed the button and it clicked open. He wet a patch of hair on the back of his wrist and tried the edge. He was standing on one foot with his leg crossed over his knee, honing the blade against the sole of his boot, when he heard someone coming and he folded the knife and slid it into his pocket and turned and went out, passing two men who smirked at him on their way to the vile latrine. A half hour later, the horn sounded across the yard for the evening meal. He waited until the last man had entered the hall and then walked in and got his tray and moved down the line. Because it was Sunday and many of the prisoners had eaten food brought by their wives or family, the hall was half empty, and he turned and stood with his tray, the beans and tortillas and the anonymous stew, and picked a table in the corner where a boy not much older than he sat alone, smoking and drinking water from a cup. He stood at the end of the table and set his tray down.
"Con permiso," he said.
The boy looked at him and blew two thin streams of smoke from his nose and nodded and reached for his cup. On the inside of his right forearm was a blue jaguar, struggling in the coils of an anaconda. In the web of his left thumb, the Pachucho cross and the five marks. Nothing out of the ordinary. But as he sat, he suddenly knew why this man was eating alone. It was too late to rise again. He picked up the spoon with his left hand and began to eat. He heard the latch click shut on the door across the hall, even above the muted scrape and click of spoons on the metal trays. He looked toward the front of the hall. There was no one behind the serving line. The two guards were gone. He continued to eat. His heart was pounding and his mouth was dry and the food was ashes. He took the knife from his pocket and put it in the waist of his trousers. The boy stubbed out the cigarette and set his cup in the tray. Outside somewhere in the streets beyond the prison walls a dog barked. A tamalera cried out her wares. John Grady realized he could not have heard these things unless every sound in the hall had ceased. He opened the knife quietly against his leg and slid it open longwise under the buckle of his belt. The boy stood and stepped over the bench and took up his tray and turned and started down along the far side of the table. John Grady held the spoon in his left hand and gripped the tray. The boy came opposite him. He passed. John Grady watched him with a lowered gaze. When the boy reached the end of the table, he suddenly turned and sliced the tray at his head. John Grady saw it all unfold slowly before him, the tray coming edgewise toward his eyes, the tin cup slightly tilted with the spoon in it, slightly upended, standing almost motionless in the air, and the boy's greasy black hair flung across his wedge-shaped face. He flung his tray up, and the corner of the boy's tray printed a deep dent in the bottom of it. He rolled away, backward, over the bench and scrabbled to his feet. He thought the tray would clatter to the table, but the boy had not let go of it, and he chopped at him with it again, coming along the edge of the bench. He fell back, fending him away, and the trays clanged, and he saw the knife for the first time pass under the trays like a cold steel newt seeking out the warmth within him. He leaped away, sliding into spilled food on the concrete floor. He pulled the knife from his belt and swung the tray backhanded and caught the cuchillero in the forehead with it. The cuchillero seemed surprised. He was trying to block John Grady's view with his tray. John Grady stepped back. He was against the wall. He stepped to the side and gripped his tray and hacked at the cuchillero's tray, trying to hit his fingers. The cuchillero moved between him and the table. He kicked back the bench behind him. The trays rattled and clanged in the otherwise silence of the hall, and the cuchillero's forehead had begun to bleed, and the blood was running down alongside his left eye. He fainted with the tray again. John Grady could smell him. He fainted, and his knife passed across the front of John Grady's shirt. John Grady dropped the tray to his midsection and moved along the wall, looking into those black eyes. The cuchillero spoke no word. His movements were precise and without rancor. John Grady knew that he was hired. He swung the tray at his head, and the cuchillero ducked and fainted and came forward. John Grady gripped the tray and moved along the wall. He ran his tongue into the corner of his mouth and tasted blood. He knew his face had been cut, but he didn't know how bad. He knew that Cuchillero had been hired because he was a man of reputation, and it occurred to him that he was going to die in this place. He looked deep into those dark eyes, and there were deeps there to look into, a whole malign history burning cold and remote and black. He moved along the wall, slicing back at the Cuchillero with the tray. He was cut again across the outside of his upper arm. He was cut across his lower chest. He turned and slashed twice at the Cuchillero with his knife. The man sucked himself up away from the blade with the boneless grace of a dervish. The men sitting at the table they were approaching had begun to rise one by one silently from the benches like birds leaving a wire. John Grady turned again and hacked at the Cuchillero with his tray, and the Cuchillero squatted, and he saw him there, thin and bow-legged under his outflung arm for one frozen moment, like some dark and reedy homunculus bent upon inhabiting him. The knife passed across his chest and passed back, and the figure moved with incredible speed, and again stood before him, crouching, silently, faintly weaving, watching his eyes. They were watching so that they could see if death were coming, eyes that had seen it before and knew the colors it traveled under and what it looked like when it got there. The tray clattered on the tiles. He realized he'd dropped it. He put his hand to his shirt. It came away sticky with blood, and he wiped it on the side of his trousers. The Cuchillero held the tray to his eyes to blind from him his movements. He looked to be adjuring him to read something writ there, but there was nothing to see save the dents and dings occasioned by the 10,000 meals eaten off it. John Grady backed away. He sat slowly on the floor. His legs were bent crookedly under him, and he slumped against the wall with his arms at either side of him. The Cuchillero lowered the tray. He set it quietly on the table. He leaned and took hold of John Grady by the hair and forced his head back to cut his throat. As he did so, John Grady brought his knife up from the floor and sank it into the Cuchillero's heart. He sank it into his heart and snapped the handle sideways and broke the blade off in him. The Cuchillero's knife clattered on the floor. From the red boutonniere blossoming on the left pocket of his blue work shirt, there spurted a thin fan of bright arterial blood. He dropped to his knees and pitched forward, dead, into the arms of his enemy. Some of the men in the hall had already stood to leave, like theater patrons anxious to avoid the crush. John Grady dropped the knife handle and pushed at the oiled head lolling against his chest. He rolled to one side and scrabbled about until he found the Cuchillero's knife. He pushed the dead man away and got hold of the table and struggled up. His clothes sagged with the weight of the blood. He backed away down the tables and turned and staggered to the door and unlatched it and walked, wobbling, out into the deep blue twilight. The light from the hall lay in a paling corridor across the yard. Where the men came to the door to watch him, it shifted and darkened in the dusk. No one followed him out. He walked with great care, holding his hand to his abdomen. The floodlights along the upper walls would come on at any moment. He walked very carefully. Blood sloshed in his boots. He looked at the knife in his hand and flung it away. The first horn would sound and the lights would come up along the walls. He felt lightheaded and curiously without pain. His hands were sticky with blood, and blood was oozing through his fingers where he held himself. The lights would be coming on and the horn would be sounding. He was halfway to the first steel ladder when a tall man overtook him and spoke to him. He turned, crouching. In the dying light, perhaps they would not see he had no knife, not see how he stood so bloody in his clothes.
Ven conmigo, said the man. Está bien. No me moleste.
The dark tears of the prison walls ran forever down the deep cyanic sky. A dog had begun to bark.
El padrote quiere ayudarle.
Monday? The man stood before him.
Ven conmigo, he said.
It was Perez's man. He held out his hand. John Grady stepped back. His boots left wet tracks of blood in the dry floor of the yard. The lights would come on. Horn would sound. He turned to go, his knees stammering under him. He fell and got up again. The mayordomo reached to help him, and he twisted out of his grip and fell again. The world swam. Kneeling, he pushed against the ground to rise. Blood dripped between his outstretched hands. The dark bank of the wall rode up the deep cyanic sky. He was lying on his side. Perez's man bent over him. He stooped and gathered him up in his arms and lifted him and carried him across the yard into Perez's house and kicked the door shut behind him as the lights came on and the horn sounded. He woke in a stone room in total darkness and the smell of disinfectant. He put his hand out to see what it would touch and felt pain all over him, like something that had been crouching there in the silence, waiting for him to stir. He put his hand down. He turned his head. A thin rod lay luminescing in the blackness. He listened, but there was no sound. Every breath he took was like a razor. After a while, he put his hand out and touched the cold block wall. "Hola," he said. His voice was weak and reedy, his face stiff and twisted. He tried again. "Hola!" There was someone there. He could feel them. "¿Quién está?" he said. But no one spoke back. There was someone there, and they had been there. There was no one there. There was someone there, and they had been there, and they had not left. But there was no one there. He looked at the floating rod of light. It was light from under a door. He listened. He held his breath and listened. Because the room was small, it seemed to be small. And if the room was small, he could hear them breathing in the dark if they were breathing. But he heard nothing. He half wondered if he were not dead. And in his despair, he felt well up in him a surge of sorrow, like a child beginning to cry, but it brought with it such pain that he stopped it cold and began at once his new life in the living of it, breath to breath. He knew he was going to get up and try the door, and he took a long time getting ready. First he moved onto his stomach. He pushed himself over all at once to get it done with. And he was just amazed at the pain. He lay breathing. He reached down to put his hand on the floor. It swung in empty space. He eased his leg over the edge and pushed himself up, and his foot touched the floor, and he lay resting on his elbows. When he reached the door, it was locked. He stood, the floor cool under his feet. He was trussed in some sort of wrapping, and he'd begun to bleed again. He could feel it. He stood, resting with his face against the cool of the metal door. He felt the bandage on his face against the door, and he touched it, and he was thirsty, out of all reason, and he rested for a long time before starting back across the floor. When the door did open, it was to blinding light, and there stood in it no ministress in white, but a demandadero, in stained and wrinkled khakis, bearing a metal mess tray with a double spoonful of pozole spilled over it and a glass of orange soda water. He was not much older than John Grady, and he backed into the room with the tray and turned, his eyes looking everywhere but at the bed. Other than a steel bucket in the floor, there was nothing in the room but the bed and nowhere to put the tray but on it. He approached and stood. He looked at once uncomfortable and menacing. He gestured with the tray. John Grady eased himself onto his side and pushed himself up. Sweat stood on his forehead. He was wearing some sort of rough cotton gown, and he'd bled through it, and the blood had dried. "Dame el refresco," he said. "Nada más."
"Nada más?"
"No." The demandadero handed him the glass of orange water, and he took it and sat holding it. He looked at the little stone block room. Overhead was a single light bulb in a wire cage. "La luz, por favor," he said. The demandadero nodded and went to the door and turned and pulled it shut after him. A click of the latch in the darkness. Then the light came on. He listened to the steps down the corridor. Then the silence. He raised the glass and slowly drank the soda. It was tepid. Only faintly effervescent, delicious. He lay there 3 days, He slept and woke and slept again. Someone turned off the light and he woke in the dark. He called out, but no one answered. He thought of his father in Goshi. He knew that terrible things had been done to him there, and he had always believed that he did not want to know about it. But now he did want to know. He lay in the dark thinking of all the things he did not know about his father, and he realized that the father he knew was all the father he would ever know. He would not think about Alejandra because he didn't know what was coming or how bad it would be, and he thought she was something he'd better save. So he thought about horses, and they were always the right thing to think about. Later, someone turned the light back on again, and it did not go off again after that. He slept, and when he woke, he had dreamt of the dead standing about in their bones, and the dark sockets of their eyes that were indeed, without speculation, bottomed in the void, wherein lay a terrible intelligence, common to all, but of which none would speak. When he woke, he knew that men had died in that room. When the door opened next, it was to admit a man in a blue suit carrying a leather bag. The man smiled at him and asked after his health. "Mejor que nunca," he said. The man smiled again. He set the bag on the bed and opened it and took out a pair of surgical scissors and pushed the bag to the foot of the bed and pulled back the blood-stained sheet. "¿Quién es usted?" said John Grady. The man looked surprised. "I am the doctor," he said. The scissors had a spade end that was cold against his skin, and the doctor slid them under the blood-stained gauze cummerbund and began to cut it away. He pulled the dressing from under him, and they looked down at the stitches. "Bien, bien," said the doctor. He pushed at the sutures with two fingers. "Bueno," he said. He cleaned the sutured wounds with an antiseptic and taped gauze pads over them and helped him to sit up. He took a large roll of gauze out of the bag and reached around John Grady's waist and began to wrap it. "Put your hands on my shoulders," he said.
"What?"
"Put your hands on my shoulders. It is all right." He put his hands on the doctor's shoulders and the doctor wrapped the dressing. "Bueno," he said. "Bueno." He rose and closed the bag and stood looking down at his patient.
"I will send for you soap and towels," he said, "so you can wash yourself."
"All right."
"You are a fest healer."
"A what?"
"A fest healer."
He nodded and smiled and turned and went out. John Grady didn't hear him latch the door, but there was no place to go anyway. His next visitor was a man he'd never seen before. He wore a uniform that looked to be military. He did not introduce himself. The guard who brought him shut the door and stood outside it. The man stood at his bed and took off his hat as though in deference to some wounded hero. Then he took a comb from the breast pocket of his tunic and passed it once along each side of his oiled head and put the hat back on again.
"How soon you can walk around?" he said.
"Where do you want me to walk to?"
"To your house."
"I can walk right now." The man pursed his lips, studying him.
"Show me you walk."
He pushed back the sheets and rolled onto his side and stepped down to the floor. He walked up and back. His feet left cold, wet tracks on the polished stones that sucked up and vanished like the tail of the world itself. The sweat stood quivering on his forehead.
"You are fortunate boys," he said.
"I don't feel so fortunate."
"Fortunate boys,"
he said again, and nodded and left. He slept and woke. He knew night from day only by the meals. He ate little. Finally they brought him half a roast chicken with rice and two halves of a tinned pear, and this he ate slowly, savoring each bite and proposing and rejecting various scenarios that might have occurred in the outer world or be occurring, or were yet to come. He still thought that he might be taken out into the campo and shot. He practiced walking up and down. He polished the underside of the mess tray with the sleeve of his shift, and standing in the center of the room under the light bulb, he studied the face that peered dimly out of the warped steel like some maimed and raging djinn conjured there. He peeled away the bandage from his face and inspected the stitches there and felt them with his fingers. When next he woke, the demandadero had opened the door and stood with a pile of clothes and with his boots. He let them fall on the floor. "Sus prendas," he said, and shut the door. He stripped out of the shift and washed himself with soap and rag and dried himself with the towel and dressed and pulled on the boots. Someone had washed the blood out of the boots and they were still wet, and he tried to take them off again, but he could not, and he lay on the bunk in his clothes and boots waiting for God knew what. Two guards came. They stood at the open door and waited for him. He got up and walked out. They went down a corridor and across a small patio and entered another part of the building. They walked down another corridor, and the guards tapped at a door and then opened it, and one of them motioned for him to enter. At a desk sat the comandante who'd been to his cell to see if he could walk. "You be seated," said the comandante. He sat. The comandante opened his desk drawer and took out an envelope and handed it across the desk. "This is you," he said. John Grady took the envelope. "Where's Rawlins?" he said.
"Excuse me?"
"Donde está mi compadre?"
"Your friend?"
"Yes."
"He wait outside."
"Where are we going?"
"You going away. You going away to your house."
"When?"
"Excuse me?"
"Cuando?"
"You going now. I don't want to see you no more."
The comandante waved his hand. John Grady put one hand on the back of the chair and rose and turned and walked out the door, and he and the guards went down the hallway and out through the office to the sally gate, where Rawlins stood, waiting in a costume much like his own. 5 minutes later, they were standing in the street, outside the tall, iron-shod wooden doors of the portal. There was a bus standing in the street, and they climbed laboriously aboard. Women in the seats with their empty hampers and baskets spoke to them softly as they made their way down the aisle.
"I thought ye'd died," said Rawlins.
"I thought you had. What happened?"
"I'll tell you. Let's just sit here. Let's not talk. Let's just sit here real quiet."
"You all right?"
"Yeah, I'm all right."
Rawlins turned and looked out the window. All was gray and still. A few drops of rain had begun to fall in the street. They dropped on the roof of the bus, solitary as a bell. Down the street he could see the arched buttresses of the cathedral dome and the minaret of the bell tower beyond.
"All my life I had the feeling that trouble was close at hand. Not that I was about to get into it, just that it was always there."
"Let's just sit here real quiet," said John Grady.
They sat watching the rain in the street. The women sat quietly. Outside it was darkening, and there was no sun nor any paler place to the sky where sun might be. Two more women climbed aboard and took their seats, and then the driver swung up and closed the door and looked to the rear in the mirror and put the bus in gear, and they pulled away. Some of the women wiped at the glass with their hands and peered back at the prison standing in the gray rain of Mexico. So, like some site of siege in an older time, in an older country, where the enemies were all from without. It was only a few blocks to the centro, and when they eased themselves down from the bus, the gas lamps were already on in the plaza. They crossed slowly to the portales on the north side of the square and stood looking out at the rain. Four men in maroon band uniforms stood along the wall with their instruments. John Grady looked at Rawlins. Rawlins looked lost, standing there hatless and afoot in his shrunken clothes.
"Let's get something to eat."
"We don't have no money."
"I got money."
"Where'd you get any money at?"
Rawlins said. "I got a whole envelope full."
They walked into a cafe and sat in a booth. A waiter came over and put menus in front of them and went away. Rawlins looked out the window.
"Get a steak," said John Grady.
"All right."
"We'll eat and get a hotel room and get cleaned up and get some sleep."
"All right."
He ordered steaks and fried potatoes and coffee for both of them, and the waiter nodded and took the menus. John Grady rose and made his way slowly to the counter and bought two packs of cigarettes and a penny box of matches each. People at their tables watched him cross the room. Rollins lit a cigarette and looked at him.
"Why ain't we dead?"
he said.
"She paid us out." "The signora?"
"The aunt, yes."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
"Is that where you got the money?"
"Yes."
"It's got to do with the girl, don't it?"
"I expect it does." Rollins smoked. He looked out the window. Outside it was already dark. The streets were wet from the rain, and the lights from the café and from the lamps in the plaza lay bleeding in the black pools of water.
"There ain't no other explanation, is there?"
"Nope." Rollins nodded.
"I could have run off from where they had me. It was just a hospital ward."
"Why didn't you?"
"I don't know. You think I was dumb not to have?"
"I don't know. Yeah, maybe."
"What would you have done?"
"I wouldn't have left you."
"Yeah, I know you wouldn't."
"That don't mean it ain't dumb." Rollins almost smiled. Then he looked away. The waiter brought the coffee.
"There was another old boy in there," said Rollins, "all cut up. Probably wasn't a bad boy. Set out on Saturday night with a few dollars in his pocket, pesos. Goddamn pathetic."
"What happened to him?"
"He died. When they carried him out of there, I thought how peculiar it would have seemed to him if he could have seen it. It did to me, and it wasn't even me. Dying ain't in people's plans, is it?"
"No." He nodded.
"They put Mexican blood in me," he said.
He looked up. John Grady was lighting a cigarette. He shook out the match and put it in the ashtray and looked at Rollins. "So?"
"So what does that mean?"
said Rollins.
"Mean about what?" "Well, does it mean I'm part Mexican?"
John Grady drew on the cigarette and leaned back and blew the smoke into the air.
"Part Mexican?" he said. "Yeah."
"How much did they put?"
"They said it was over a liter."
"How much over a liter?"
"I don't know."
"Well, a liter would make you almost a half-breed." Rollins looked at him.
"It don't, does it?" he said.
"No, hell, it don't mean nothing. Blood's blood. It don't know where it come from." The waiter brought the steaks. They ate. He watched Rollins. Rollins looked up.
"What?"
he said. "Nothing."
"You ought to be happier about being out of that place."
"I was thinking the same thing about you." Rollins nodded.
"Yeah," he said.
"What do you want to do?"
"Go home."
"All right." They ate.
"You're going back down there, ain't you?"
said Rollins. "Yeah, I guess I am."
"On account of the girl?"
"Yeah."
"What about the horses?"
"The girl and the horses."
Rollins nodded. "You think she's looking for you to come back?"
"I don't know."
"I'd say the old lady might be surprised to see you."
"No, she won't. She's a smart woman."
"What about Rocha?"
"He'll have to do whatever he has to do."
Rollins crossed his silver and the platter beside the bones and took out his cigarettes. "Don't go down there," he said.
"I done made up my mind."
Rollins lit the cigarette and shook out the match. He looked up. "There's only one kind of deal I can see that you could have made with the old woman."
"I know, but she's going to have to tell me herself."
"If she does, will you come back?"
"I'll come back."
"All right.
I still want the horses."
Rollins shook his head and looked away.
"I ain't asking you to go with me," said John Grady.
"I know you ain't."
"You'll be all right."
"Yeah, I know."
He tapped the ash from his cigarette and pushed at his eyes with the heel of his hand and looked out the window. Outside it was raining again. There was no traffic in the streets.
"Kid over yonder trying to sell newspapers," he said. "Ain't a soul in sight, and him standing there with his papers up under his shirt just a-hollering."
He wiped his eyes with the back of his hand.
"Ah, shit," he said.
"What?"
"Nothing, just Shit.
What is it?
I keep thinking about old Blevins.
John Grady didn't answer. Rollins turned and looked at him. His eyes were wet, and he looked old and sad.
I can't believe they just walked him out there and done him that way.
Yeah.
I keep thinking about how scared he was.
You'll feel better when you get home.
Rollins shook his head and looked out the window again.
I don't think so, he said.
John Grady smoked. He watched him. After a while, he said,
I ain't Blevins.
Yeah, said Rollins, I know you ain't, but I wonder how much better off you are than him.
John Grady stubbed out his cigarette. Let's go, he said. They bought toothbrushes and a bar of soap and a safety razor at a pharmacia, and they found a room in a hotel 2 blocks down Aldama. The key was just a common door key tied to a wooden fob with the number of the room burned into the wood with a hot wire. They walked out across the tiled courtyard where the rain was falling lightly and found the room and opened the door and turned on the light. A man sat up in the bed and looked at them. They backed out and turned off the light and shut the door and went back to the desk where the man gave them another key. The room was bright green, and there was a shower in one corner with an oilcloth curtain on a ring. John Grady turned down the shower, and after a while there was hot water in the pipes. He turned it off again.
Go ahead, he said.
You go ahead.
I got to come out of this tape.
He sat on the bed and peeled away the dressings while Rollins showered. Rollins turned off the water and pushed back the curtain and stood drying himself with one of the threadbare towels.
We're a couple of good uns, ain't we?
He said.
Yeah.
How you going to get them stitches out?
I guess I'll have to find a doctor.
It hurts worse taking them out than putting them in.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew that.
Rollins wrapped the towel around himself and sat on the bed opposite. The envelope with the money was lying on the table.
How much is in there?
John Grady looked up.
I don't know, he said. Considerable less than what there were supposed to be, I'll bet. Go ahead and count it.
He took the envelope and counted the bills out on the bed.
970 pesos,
he said. John Grady nodded.
How much is that?
About $120.
Rollins tapped the sheaf of bills together on the glass of the tabletop and put them back in the envelope.
Split it in 2 piles, said John Grady.
I don't need no money.
Yes, you do.
I'm going home.
Don't make no difference. Half of it's yours.
Rollins stood and hung the towel over the iron bedstead and pulled back the covers.
I think you're going to need every dime of it, he said.
When he came out of the shower, he thought Rollins was asleep, but he wasn't. He crossed the room and turned off the light and came back and eased himself into the bed. He lay in the dark, listening to the sounds in the street, the dripping of rain in the courtyard.
You ever pray? Said Rollins.
Yeah, sometimes. I guess I got kindly out of the habit.
Rollins was quiet for a long time. Then he said,
What's the worst thing you ever done?
I don't know. I guess if I'd done anything real bad, I'd rather not tell it. Why?
I don't know. I was in the hospital, cut, and I got to thinking. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't supposed to be here. You ever think like that?
Yeah, sometimes.
He lay in the dark, listening. Someone crossed the patio. A door opened and closed again.
You ain't never done nothing bad, said John Grady.
Me and Lamont one time drove a pickup truckload of feed to Sterling City and sold it to some Mexicans and kept the money.
That ain't the worst thing I ever heard of.
I've done some other stuff, too.
If you're going to talk, I'm going to smoke a cigarette.
I'll shut up.
They lay quietly in the dark.
You know about what happened, don't you? Said John Grady.
You mean in the mess hall?
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Grady reached and got his cigarettes off the table and lit one and blew out the match. I never thought I'd do that.
You didn't have no choice.
Still never thought it.
He'd have done it to you.
He drew on the cigarette and blew the smoke unseen into the darkness.
You don't need to try and make it right. It is what it is.
Rollins didn't answer.
After a while, he said, "Where'd you get the knife?"
"Off the Bautistas. I bought it with the last 45 pesos we had."
"Blevins' money?"
"Yeah, Blevins' money."
Rawlins was lying on his side in the spring-shot iron bedstead, watching him in the dark. The cigarette glowed a deep red where John Grady drew on it, and his face, with the sutures in his cheek, emerged from the darkness like some dull red theatric mask, indifferently repaired and faded back again.
"I knew when I bought the knife what I bought it for."
"I don't see where you were wrong."
The cigarette glowed. It faded. "I know," he said. "But you didn't do it."
In the morning it was raining again, and they stood outside the same café with toothpicks in their teeth and looked at the rain and the plaza. Rawlins studied his nose in the glass. "You know what I hate?"
"What?"
"Showing up at the house looking like this."
John Grady looked at him and looked away. "I don't blame you," he said.
"You don't look so hot yourself."
John Grady grinned. "Come on," he said.
They bought new clothes and hats in a Victoria Street haberdashery and wore them out into the street, and in the slow, falling rain walked down to the bus station and bought Rawlins a ticket for Nuevo Laredo. They sat in the bus station café in the stiff new clothes with the new hats turned upside down on the chairs at either side, and they drank coffee until the bus was announced over the speaker.
"That's you," said John Grady.
They rose and put on their hats and walked out to the gates.
"Well," said Rawlins, "I reckon I'll see you one of these days."
"You take care."
"Yeah, you take care."
He turned and handed his ticket to the driver, and the driver punched it and handed it back, and he climbed stiffly aboard. John Grady stood watching while he passed along the aisle. He thought he'd take a seat at the window, but he didn't. He sat on the other side of the bus. And John Grady stood for a while and then turned and walked back out through the station to the street and walked slowly back through the rain to the hotel. He exhausted in the days following the roster of surgeons in that small upland desert metropolis without finding one to do what he asked. He spent his days walking up and down in the narrow streets until he knew every corner and callejón. At the end of a week, he had the stitches removed from his face, sitting in a common metal chair, the surgeon humming to himself as he snipped with his scissors and pulled with his clamp. The surgeon said that the scar would improve in its appearance. He said for him not to look at it, because it would get better with time. Then he put a bandage over it and charged him 50 pesos and told him to come back in 5 days, and he would remove the stitches from his belly. A week later, he left Saltillo on the back of a flatbed truck heading north. The day was cool and overcast. There was a large diesel engine chained to the bed of the truck. He sat in the truck bed as they jostled out through the streets, trying to brace himself, his hands at either side on the rough boards. After a while, he pulled his hat down hard over his eyes and stood and placed his hands outstretched on the roof of the cab and rode in that manner, as if he were some personage bearing news for the countryside. As if he were some newfound evangelical being conveyed down out of the mountains and north across the flat, bleak landscape toward Monclova. Part 4. At a crossroads station somewhere on the other side of Paredón, they picked up 5 farm workers, who climbed up on the bed of the truck and nodded and spoke to him with great circumspection and courtesy. It was almost dark, and it was raining lightly, and they were wet, and their faces were wet in the yellow light from the station. They huddled forward of the chained engine, and he offered them his cigarettes, and they thanked him each and took one, and they cupped their hands over the small flame against the falling rain and thanked him again.
"De donde viene?" they said.
"De Tejas."
"Tejas," they said.
"Y donde va?" He drew on his cigarette. He looked at their faces. One of them, older than the rest, nodded at his cheap new clothes.
"Ella a ver a su novia," he said.
They looked at him earnestly, and he nodded and said that it was true.
"Ah," they said. "Qué bueno."
And after and for a long time to come,
he'd have reason to evoke the recollection of those smiles, and to reflect upon the goodwill which provoked them, for it had power to protect and to confer